Good evening, and welcome to A Fireside Chat. I am your host, Lance White, sometimes referred to as Zany Mystic. Tonight's guest is Swami Abhayananda. Swami was graced with the experience of God realization in 1966 and chose an awakened life. His path led him to the mysteries of the East. In India, he studied with Swami Muktananda and was sent to New York to teach in an ashram. He became a director of Philadelphia, then Chicago, then Oklahoma ashrams, and remained a disciple of Swami Muktananda for 10 years. Since then, he's published several books, The Supreme Self and the History of Mysticism, and in addition to teaching meditation and spirituality locally. Let's find out more about the mystic path by welcoming Swami Abhayananda. I knew I was going to screw that up. Swami Abhayananda. Welcome, Swami.
Thank you very much. Hi, Lance. How are you?
All right. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Oh, good, good, good. You know, I really enjoyed your book, The Supreme Self. I thought it was a wonderful journey. And, you know, it reminded me of me in my early days, because I remember, I'm 56 now, so I was born in 1950, and my spiritual quest started out kind of young, too, and I had dreams of, you know, going off into a cabin and, you know, living in the woods and, you know, finding out matter spiritual and mystical, but you actually did it.
Yes, that's the unusual part.
I mean,
yes, it was a wonderful time.
Yes. What was that experience like, that initial experience that you had of God realization, and how did that change your life?
Well, let me take a little moment to first set up the situation. This was the time of the hippies, as you know, 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of people kind of going out into communities at the time.
Uh-huh.
In fact, where I lived, there were quite a few of these hippie communities, communes. And but I was alone. Unless you lived during that time, you can't really understand the feeling that was around at the time. It was a very spiritual time.
Yeah.
You know. I guess we only know about it in retrospect, but people who lived through that know that it was an awakening time for many people.
Uh-huh.
I had been living with a woman, young woman, and we had kind of set up a home and so forth. But I got a hold of a book called Vedanta for the Western World. And it was my first introduction to Vedanta, and it had quite an influence on me.
Uh-huh.
Especially learning about the life of Sri Ramakrishna. He was one of these ecstatic beings who fell into samadhi at the drop of a hat.
Wow.
And, yes, he was an amazing person, and I was just getting introduced to this mystical fervor that was had somehow escaped me. I had been a student of philosophy, but I had really omitted the deeper levels of it, you know.
Yeah.
And had been kind of a atheistic sort of person, I guess.
Huh.
But when this fervor hit me of realizing things from this book I was reading, and inspired by the life of Sri Ramakrishna, I started feeling, you know, some sort of spiritual awakening. It was as though there was light coming down on the back of my neck, and, you know, there was this ecstatic feeling, a devotional feeling, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really changed my life. And I decided that I was going to devote my life to this. I needed to find a place where I could meditate quietly. And I knew that this meant disrupting my present state of life.
Huh.
So I left this young woman and gave her the possessions we had in common and went off into the Santa Cruz Mountains.
Huh.
Now, at the time, there was a university that just started there, the University of California at Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh.
And this turned out to be fairly near where that is. If you go out toward the university, you go up High Street, and then you kind of go out around the university, and you come to a road called Smith Grade.
Uh-huh.
And it goes down very steeply and curves around and goes down to the ocean. And it was on that road where this little cabin was found. And it was an abandoned cabin, to all appearances. There was a cord of wood stacked outside, as though someone had either lived there or planned to live there. And it had a little outhouse. It had a brook running behind it.
Wow.
Nice, clear, cool water. It was just like something... It was as though God had imagined this just for me, you know.
Wow.
It was very idealistic.
You have a picture of it in the book, and it's about the most perfect, picture-perfect little cabin you can imagine.
Yeah, it was quite isolated, off the road and down, so that you couldn't really see it from the road going by.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about 500 acres involved in this property that went along with this cabin,
wow.
as I later learned. And then around that, there was another 1,000 acres of forest land that was owned by the university.
Ah.
And kept, you know, in a pristine sort of way. So I had all this space to call my own and to roam around in and meditate in. And so it was quite an Eden, to live in.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, as I say, in 1966, and I stayed there for 5 years in that cabin. So anyway, I began doing a lot of meditation, prayer. At one point, I sort of panicked and went running down the road. I was going to get a job and, you know, get away from this craziness. But I was drawn back because that's what I had come out to the forest for, was to realize God.
Yeah.
And so at the same time I was spending a lot of time alone, I was also walking into the university and reading a lot in their library and taking home books. And so I got a lot of a good education because I was still fairly new to the mystical approach. And so I was reading, you know, Rumi and Shankara and people like that. And
uh-huh.
Everything I could find in the library, which was a very good library.
Oh, yeah.
So I got a lot of information that way. But primarily it was just me and my cabin, and at night with the fire going, I didn't mention, but it had a little wood stove in the cabin.
Oh, my goodness.
And I would sit there. I cooked on that wood stove, and at night I would sit next to it to keep warm and watch the coals through the grating, you know.
Uh-huh.
And get into a nice state. Sometimes I would sing songs to God, and you know, it was just no one came by, so it was a very private and quiet place.
Yeah.
During the day, I'd sometimes, you know, bring wood down for my fires and so forth. But that was my routine. I would go into the university, and I would work around the cabin. And then at night, about 6 o'clock, I'd put a note on my door, don't disturb me, and I would spend my evenings in prayer. So on, it was November the 18th, 1966, I went there, it was about sometime in August, I guess. Yeah. And by November, it started to get rainy and cool in California. And so one night I was sitting by the stove and praying, and I noticed I had gotten very quiet, and my eyes were very, my pupils were very wide, as though, I guess, from the light of the stove, I don't know what, but anyway, I felt quite different, and a prayer came out of me at that time, just spontaneously, for God to grant me this experience of oneness with Him, and that I would, so that I could praise Him and give Him thanks. And within moments, this experience came to me, and as you know, I've described it somewhat in my book, The Supreme Self.
Yes.
But it, over the phone, it's I'm probably just going to stutter a little bit, and it's very difficult to describe something like this. But it was a completely different state of consciousness than what one is in normally.
Right.
It was like going into another dimension or something.
Mm-hmm.
In that, I was aware that my body was not mine, but it was it belonged to God. It was part of the universe, you know. And there was no me to hold any possession of it. And along with this feeling, the sense of the opposites that come in our lives, you know, the love and hate and life and death and all the various opposites that we have, we're gone. We're resolved in this oneness. And it was a kind of a gradual thing in that at first I was aware of the fact that I was part of this universe and I was seeing the interconnectedness of things and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the experience deepened, I became aware that I was deeper than that. I was the consciousness that was at the root of all of this universal array.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced eternity. I experienced the breathing out of the universe. I watched the universe go out and come back in, and you know, in the billions of years that it takes. But it was from the vantage point of eternity, it was just a breath.
A breath, yes.
Yeah. So that's basically the experience. When I at the end of it, my mind started coming down. Difficult to hold on to. It was like walking on a keen edge, you know, and I was losing that focus.
Yes.
Of course, it was all God's grace, and so you know, it wasn't me doing it, but this was what I was experiencing from my end.
Yeah.
And I went immediately to sleep. I was exhausted.
Hmm.
And then I woke up in the morning, and immediately, you know, remembered everything. And I went outside and I bent down and picked up a handful of gravel from the driveway, and just let it kind of slip through my fingers. I was trying to recapture that experience that I was in everything, and you know, I was even in that gravel.
Mm.
And my mind couldn't quite fathom it because I was no longer in that experience, and I longed so much to be back in that state of eternal consciousness.
Oh, yes.
That I went, I probably should have, excuse me, I probably should have just sat down and meditated, you know, and gotten myself quiet. But
yeah.
I went running up the mountainside and where I used to sit and look out over the ocean and pray. And so I sat there and, you know, wept, hoping that God would take me back into that experience. But it wasn't to be. It was a large gray fog came up from the ocean and went over me, and I got cool and I had to go back down.
Wow.
So that was the end of that experience.
Wow.
However, it did stay with me. It was a time in my life that, you know, was a unique and one-of-a-kind time, and I enjoyed it so much. I was like a man living in paradise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, later I went to India and so forth, and you know about all that.
Yes, yes. What took you to India, by the way? And I kind of wanted to segue into that anyway.
Well, I'd been in the forest for, I guess, about 3 or 4 years by this time.
Uh-huh.
And I used to go stand downtown and hand out my poems that I had written. especially those that I had written during this experience.
Wow.
And I was standing there one day when this man came by who had a very sweet countenance, and he put some money in my box and had read my poems, and we had a few words. And later I discovered that his name was Baba Ramdas.
Oh.
He had been in town to present Swami Muktananda, who was on tour and was going to appear at the university that evening.
Wow.
So a friend of mine came by the cabin and you know, had tickets for this appearance of Muktananda. And so we went, and it was quite an experience. It was a beautiful night, full of this sense of spiritual happening of some sort, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went to the to the university, and I was very impressed with Muktananda. It wasn't so much what he had said, because he was saying things I'd heard before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was his just his being. I was kind of losing him in this blue light, and he was not like anyone I'd ever seen before.
Yeah,
he had a particular energy about him. And so at the end of the program, when he was coming off of the stage and Baba Ramdas was leading a chant for the people, I ran down and got right in front of Muktananda coming up the aisle and held up my hands to him, wanting him to touch me. And he tipped his sunglasses up to see what kind of a fool this was in front of him. And then he just slapped my hands and gave me what I wanted.
Oh.
And I followed him out. Pardon me?
I was just laughing about that. It sounds funny.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a totally spontaneous thing.
Uh-huh.
And I followed him out to the car that was waiting for him, and he rolled down the window and waved to me, and I was totally enthralled. I was like everybody else, like one of the gopis who is, you know, standing in front of Krishna. I was enthralled with him.
Yeah, I've had that experience.
So that was my first experience of him. I didn't have any sense that he was going to be my guru or that I was going to go to India or anything.
Wow.
Until much later, when I read his book, Play of Consciousness, and then I decided I wanted to go there, and I wrote to him, and he said, yes, come. So, of course, I didn't have any money, but circumstances evolved and conspired to allow me to get to India. That was in 72, early 72.
Okay.
After that, I did get there through the help of a friend who loaned me some money. And I had tried to work, and I was doing all kinds of things, and wasn't saving that much money. I was living in terrible circumstances, and I got there through some help. And it was quite an experience. Muktananda's had a very large ashram in rural India, in Ganeshpuri. It's about 60 miles north of Bombay, which is now Mumbai. And it looked like a castle. It was had orange flags flying from the top, and
wow.
It looked like Disneyland, you know.
So, gee. So this wasn't a poverty-stricken ashram. This was a This one was well-founded. Sounds like.
Yes. He had a lot of wealthy patrons.
Yeah.
And devotees, and they kept the place supplied with food and everything that was needed.
Wow.
So it was quite a comfortable place to be.
What was your initiation like with the Swami? I mean, were you able to? I know that usually isn't the student it doesn't have a great deal of contact at first. And what was that experience like living in the ashram there in India, where the mystical experience kind of originates?
Well, Muktananda was an amazing human being. He was so fascinating that all of us students used to stand around and just watch him if we had the chance. You know, he would just come out and sit on his little perch on his little platform that he sat out on, and it was a beautiful courtyard with cobblestones, and the temple was beautiful marble and so forth. It was a very beautiful place, and large grounds. There were probably about 70 of us there at the time. People from Australia, U.S., Europe, a lot of Westerners, and we would the guys would work in the garden, you know, outside, and do pretty hard work most of the day. We got up very, very early, 3 or 4:30, I think it was, and for meditation, and then we would do our jobs, and either we were cleaning toilets or we were working out in the gardens, or during the monsoon season we might be making quilts, you know.
Oh, okay.
It's because we had to be inside; it was just too much water.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite varied. And then in the afternoon we'd chant again. We'd have a little bit of after lunch. We would get a little rest because you didn't want to be out in that hot sun during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then again later we'd do a little bit of work and then dinner and so forth. And he was always accessible, but as you say, you don't have a lot of contact in the early days with a guru like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was very impersonal contact, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
With you know one or two little personal contacts thrown in,
yeah.
But he was a pretty aloof person. He didn't spend a lot of time with anybody really. But he was someone that you just wanted to watch because he was so beautiful. The glow from his skin and his state of consciousness was so all-pervading when you would be near him that it would just draw you into meditation.
Wow.
Yeah, he was quite an amazing person. The first time he had a place where he used to meditate, I guess when he was a little younger and was just setting up the ashram, and it was down below his residence, and next to it and around it, he had built a meditation hall for the students there. And I was kind of reluctant to go down into it because I'd heard stories that it was mosquitoes, you know, and it was very dark and so forth.
Uh-huh.
So it took me a couple of days before I got up the courage to go down into this thing. This is just to give you an idea of the kind of experiences one had there.
Uh-huh.
And I went down into the cave, as we call it, and as soon as I crossed the threshold of the door and went inside, it was total black, of course.
Mm.
It took you a while to get your eyesight to where you could make your way, you know, along the wall to have a find a place to sit. But as soon as I crossed that threshold, everything went blue inside my head, not outside.
Well, that's
you know, you close your eyes and usually it's just black.
It's black, yeah.
But when I closed my eyes, everything was blue. Just brilliant, beautiful sky blue.
Wow.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. And I sat there in that experience through the whole time I sat down for meditation that day. That was the only time it ever happened, but it was kind of telling me that, you know, not to be afraid of coming down into the cave.
Yeah.
There were many experiences I had with Muktananda, some of which I don't want to go into. They're just part of my private file,
right.
You know.
Right.
But I did love the man very much, and I was very disappointed much later when he turned out to be weak like all flesh, and you know, was doing some things he shouldn't have been doing with some of the young ladies.
And, it seems to be a common downfall of just about everybody. I mean, not
yeah,
everybody.
You know.
It's like for whatever reason, where maybe it's work on humiliation or humility that, you know, no matter how high you go in terms of spirituality, you're still in the flesh. You know, my own teacher got into some trouble along those lines for dallying with some of the students from some of his students, and of course Rajneesh Osho.
Yeah.
And his little entourage, so.
And then there was Sai Baba.
Yeah, Sai Baba, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it does mean, but ideally, one would want to be able to transcend the body, I would think.
Yes, there have been a few, you know, great ones like Ramana Maharshi and here in this country, Paramahansa Yogananda.
Oh, yeah.
There's no scandal around him at all.
Yeah. And Ram Dass is still alive, too, isn't he?
Ram Dass is still alive, yeah.
Yes, he was quite a revolutionary.
Yes, but not of the caliber of people I was just mentioning, you know, Sri
Ramaraji
and so forth. But he is certainly a respected teacher.
Right. Did you ever witness any quote, miracles, unquote, the things that were, you know, beyond explanation, beyond rational reason in India?
Well, Muktananda was a man of many cities. You know what cities are, I suppose. They're these supernatural powers that yogis to acquire.
Okay.
And he had them all.
Really?
He knew what, you know, he knew what you were thinking. He knew everything. You just, when you sat in his presence, you really watched your mind very closely, because he was tuned in to everybody. And
really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I've heard that some of the swamis can literally leave this dimension. I mean, they literally disappear and come back.
Well, there are stories, but I have no, immediate knowledge of those things.
Right. Right.
But he was, he had all the abilities, and
wow.
I wouldn't put anything past him.
And it's funny, like you said, when you're in the presence of someone who has conquered the various states, then you're transparent, and you know you're transparent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a feeling that you can't get away from yourself. You know, yep. It's almost like it's like being with God. You know.
Yes.
And
he was able to. He was able to come into my consciousness and mm-hmm. speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the mechanism for that or anything. I can't mm-hmm. explain it, but he was able to do that to give me words of command or whatever mm-hmm. through, you know, just coming into me. He was mm-hmm. Quite amazing. The life with Muktananda was, and it wasn't just me. I mean, everybody that was there had some story mm-hmm. to tell about how they had come to him in a dream. He had come to them and mm-hmm. asked them to come to India and so forth. And everybody had some terrific experiences to talk about. So he was quite an amazing person. It was a shame that he ended the way he did, because it tends to take away quite a bit from his reputation, you know. And I'm sure that at some plane he's very sad about the way things turned out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's so much meat here that we can grab onto, and I think the thing that I was really amazed in about your book is that it continually got me back to realizing that the essence of all religions is one, and the duality is an illusion or something that, you know, we perceive, which is not necessarily the way things are, and it's almost as if it requires being able to hold paradox or different thoughts in your mind at the same time. That yes, from a certain level we have freedom and will, and from another I within us we don't. What's your view? You spent your life pursuing God. Did he show up again in your life like he did in that initial moment, or is that something that fades, and is that a gift of grace that we get periodically and we have to live with it and pray for the next one, or, you know, how do
we
get...
Well, that's kind of the way I live, is I'm always looking for that deep experience again, but the truth of the matter is that that was my peak moment, and I've never had a similar experience. I guess, you know, one of the things that I explored in my book, Supreme Self, was the fact that at some point, about, I think it was about 7 years after I was with Muktananda, I started getting interested in astrology.
Oh, yes.
And I decided I would draw up a chart for that time of that experience to see what... you know, what the universe was doing at that time to bring that about. And it was quite an extraordinary time for me astrologically.
Uh-huh.
So seeing that chart for that time, I tended to feel that, you know, everything is really, I don't want to say determined, but it's... it happens the way it's supposed to happen, you know.
Right.
Because the universe itself was in cahoots, you know, to bring this about, this experience. I mean, everything, the cabin and the time and everything was, you know, the sense of devotion that was there, all of this, we can just simply say it was grace. But then if you break that down a little bit, you know, there was something going on in the heavens that would bringing about also some movement in me that was bringing me to that experience. I didn't know it at the time, but you know, that's where it was headed. And that chart was, as I say, very extraordinary. I haven't been able to develop very much that idea, because there's so few enlightened people who leave the data about the time and place, you know, that you can really look at. But I'm sure that for everyone there's similar things, because everything in the universe, as I experienced in this moment with God, is interconnected and is all things move together of one accord. And assent is given throughout the whole universe to every falling grain. You know, it's that line from the Bible that says, you know, he knows every sparrow that falls. And, it's like that. It's everything is in God's mind, and it's happens the way He set it to be.
Is it possible that that the mind of God, that we're in the we're literally in the mind of God?
I'm losing you. I'm getting an echo.
Is it possible that our experience here is similar to yours with the Swami Muktananda, where he was aware of everything within, where that universe of the school is like life is for God? You know, does it make sense?
Well, Lance, I'm having trouble with the audio. I'm getting.
Sorry.
I'm getting an echo, and are you doing anything different?
no. Can you hear me now?
Well, now it's better, yeah.
All right.
Can you repeat that question for me?
Oh, yes. Is it possible that we're literally in the mind of God?
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, there's no doubt about it in my mind that everything is the thought of God, and of course everything is in God. So we are living in a dream, as it were. Though you know, I don't like to say that God is dreaming. He's not. It's that kind of a reality that's similar to our dream reality.
Mm-hmm. Isn't this particular age supposed to be the end of a yuga?
Oh, you got me. I don't.
Oh.
You know, I'm not an expert on the yugas.
Oh, okay. You mentioned astrology. We're coming up on some kind of galactic alignment in 2012.
Well, you know, I've read about some things like that, but I have not confirmed them for myself. So it's you know, it's not something that I'm real familiar with.
What do you feel about what do you make of our immersion in materialistic pursuits here in America? Does it seem that we've lost our way, or, you know, are we, is this the descent and we're going to snap out of this this trap, or, you know, what can people do? I guess we just have to each find our own way along through all this, right?
Yes, indeed. As you know, I have a book coming out shortly about mysticism and science, and especially dealing with the question of the materialistic science of today.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a big concern of mine lately, and this is why I've written about it. Science is not necessarily materialistic, but in our particular society, it is.
Right.
It's taken on that characteristic. And this kind of split between the materialists and the idealists, which has been going on for 2,500 years at least, you know, is one that continues very fervently. And there are a lot of people who believe that the universe, the material universe, is materially originated, and that consciousness itself is a result of material connections in the brain and so forth. And then there are the idealists like Plato and others who believe and know that the universe is produced by a mind rather than by material things, you know.
Right.
And all of our religions are based on that precept, you know, that God is a mind whose thought is the universe, you know.
Yeah. Why is there so much divisiveness among religions today?
Well, the religions are different in that they are historical, you know. They deal with historical facts rather than necessarily with mystical connection with God.
Right.
You have Christianity that's totally based around the life of Jesus and what, you know, they think of him. And then there's the Mohammedans who, you know, are based around his teachings and his life and so forth. Hinduism has its own, you know, Krishna and so forth, has its own myths, and as all religions do. But there are two levels of religion, you know. You can find in Christianity, for example, a lower level, a sort of a populist approach to religion, and then you find the higher mystical contemplative types of religious people. So the Christianity of the one is not really the same as the Christianity of the other, and this goes with for Islam and Hinduism and all the others as well.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the person, you know, how deep is the well.
Right. In your studies, what did you find about the idea of reincarnation? Is that something that do you feel like that as souls that we incarnate repeatedly, or to learn lessons, or is this something? How do you view that?
I view it very cautiously. I don't have any direct knowledge that I can say, you know, for certain this is
right.
The way it is.
Right.
So I base my thinking on reason and the documentation that others have made who have experienced certain things. You know, there are people who have had near-death experiences, who have separated from the body, and who have knowledge that I don't necessarily have. There are
right.
people who have experienced remembrances of past births and so forth that I can't authenticate. But I, you know, I guess you approach it as either you believe or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I'm convinced that reincarnation is true. That we have to evolve, and there has to be an evolution. And so it's the evolution of the soul that brings us to where we are. Now,
yeah.
when you do a horoscope chart for someone, it's like a snowflake. It's very different than anybody else's, and it's quite clear that the characteristics of that person are embodied in that moment that they're born,
uh-huh.
and the whole universe is involved in this. It's coordinated with the, you know, with the reincarnation of a soul.
Okay.
And so, and in fact, you know, this shooting in Virginia, the fellow that was responsible for that, I had a look at his chart, and it's just quite clear that this was a soul who was very, you know, violently disposed from the very beginning. I mean, he must have been a Genghis Khan or something in a past life.
Really?
And it's a shame that psychologists don't all have access to those kinds of things. They would have been able to help this man earlier than they did.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I forget what my point was. We were talking about reincarnation.
Right.
We do reincarnate, and each birth is a sort of fresh start, and yet we have all of those memories, all of those samskaras, as the Indians call it, that are remembrances that are deep in the soul,
uh-huh.
that make us what we are. You know, a Mozart who's born, you know, with all that talent, or a Beethoven, had to have gotten some of that acquired in an earlier time, you know.
Right.
And the same way with the person with poetic talents or writing talents or any kind of thing. Everything is a progression of our soul, and all of these soul memories that stay with us are part of our heritage, you know, previous births.
Well, that would make sense.
Yeah. Astrology is good in that respect. It won't help you to know God, unfortunately, but it will help you to know your own personal soul, you know, and how it embodies and what are the main purposes involved there.
Mm-hmm.
We have this sort of dual identity. We are all the eternal, you know, we are all God in essence.
Uh-huh.
And yet we are also these individual souls. They're like superimposed on our deeper consciousness, which is the eternal, you know, one.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this kind of temporary identity that stays with us for over births, but it's not our final and eternal identity.
Mm-hmm.
We, according to the philosophy of the Indians, we are all moving toward the realization of our eternal reality so that we can transcend its birth and death and not have to keep on the wheel of returning.
Yeah, that seems like it would be a desirable state to be in, especially given, you know, the state of affairs of the world today.
Yes, and I'm afraid that things are going to get worse. It's just from what I see the astrology future, it's we're headed for a rougher period than we've gone through. I'm an old man now, and I'm not going to be around for it, but it's going to be a tough one, I think.
What have you seen in your astrological calculations in terms of our future?
Well, there's a consensus. There's a wonderful book that recently came out, and I just want to mention it, by a man named Richard Tarnas, who wrote this book called Cosmos and Psyche. And it has to do with astrology.
Okay.
It is kind of an attempt to convince, I guess you might say, that there really is a correlation between the heavens and the earth and our,
uh-huh,
our lives. And it's a brilliant book, and it tells about the major planetary aspects that were in effect during various periods in our history, the Renaissance and so forth, and
uh-huh,
how it affected people who were instrumental in bringing about those scientific discoveries and so forth. And it's an amazing book because it really shows how these things are coordinated astrologically. I know astrology is not a popular subject among the scientific minded, but you know, one day it's going to have to become the major science of all, because as I mentioned with this young man who killed all these people, it would have been a help to know something about his psychology through this deeper way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid that we're not ready as a whole society for understanding this right now. There are a lot more people than used to that are willing to delve into astrology and look at it in a rational way, but there's still a lot of prejudice, mm-hmm, superstition.
How far out have you done your calculations in terms of what's going on with the heavens?
Well, I mentioned this book because it primarily what I understand is derived from what Mr. Tarnas has has spoken of in this book about the planetary aspects that are coming up, the major planets, and it looks pretty threatening. It's like it's like a weather forecast, you know. If you know that clouds are so many miles away and the wind's blowing them this direction, well, then you know you're going to get it. And that's kind of what's going on. If you judge also from what has happened in the past and what these kinds of influences tend to signify, you know, historically, well, then you can derive from that an understanding that it's going to be a difficult time.
Yeah.
Even this period, the Bush years, you know, is projected in astrology to be you know, the way it is. So, you know, it makes you kind of a fatalist when you see that, guys, this is all part of God's, you know, unfolding plan. Nothing is by mistake. It's all, you know, lessons that we're to learn.
And in some sense, some people even claim that everything we do is basically scripted. You know,
yeah, I guess you could say that. It's very difficult to put into words, you know, because you tend to end up saying that everything is determined and nobody likes determinism.
Right, right.
So, but all things are connected, and it is a causal universe because it's
right.
Caused by the one who's who's dreaming it, you know.
Right.
Who's thinking
right.
it?
You know, when you talked about the astrological influences, it brought to mind the global warming that seems to be coming to light now.
Yeah, that's another thing. Mm-hmm.
That seems, and the bees are disappearing. You know. I think Einstein said that if they actually disappeared, we'd have about 4 years left, and they do seem to be leaving in droves.
The what?
There's a lot of stuff that seems to be coming together, like you said.
Uh-huh.
And I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, whether you look at astrology or no matter how you slice it, it looks like hard times are on the way.
Yeah, yeah. It's
we chose to be here, right?
That's right. Yeah. I'm sure it'll all come out good in the end.
Yeah.
Apparently we need to go through some, you know, a lot of soul lessons in the meantime.
Yes. Well, I have a feeling we're going to be going through quite a few condensed ones in the near future because everything seems to be speeding up exponentially.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. Well, you just have to, you know, bring it down to your own level of what you can do, and
right.
And what you can do is to be holy within yourself, you know. And,
exactly, and you know, finding the God within is, you know, that seems to be so crucial. I mean, for me, that's really important. That the understanding that God is not outside myself; that God is within me.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of different teachings claim that there's an outside God, and I've just never been able to relate to those. They don't seem to make any sense to me whatsoever. And then when you have a God that's outside of yourself, you have intermediaries, which supposedly are going to help you make that connection, and of course it costs money to do that. They charge in one way or another.
Yeah.
So... But do you still meditate?
Well, I did mention, I see we're getting close to the hour. I did mention that I have a new book coming out.
Oh, yeah, tell me about that.
It's Mysticism and Science.
Okay.
A Call for Reconciliation. And it's going to be out in, very few days. The 25th it's supposed to be in stores.
Wonderful.
And, it was kind of a surprise to me that this book just... you know, was born on the fly, so to speak. It wasn't something that I spent many years working over, but rather, again, bringing in astrology, it was a period when there was a particular thing going on that just sparked my inspiration and got
right.
me writing. And I cranked it out pretty quickly.
Wow.
But it has all of it's almost like a bit of channeled writing in that sense, in that it just came out of me quite spontaneously, and it has a lot of good things to say, I think, in that focusing on science and what the differences are and how to reconcile these two sides of you know, our understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Because science, of course, is very good. We don't want to do away with science.
It's just out with the bathwater, right?
Right. It's just that we need to somehow get these scientific minds to understand that the mystics of this world that have been around for ages and ages have been all saying pretty much the same thing, and we need to utilize that and regard it as knowledge, not as they do now, as some sort of super old superstitions,
mm-hmm.
but to utilize the knowledge of the mystics and to try to bring both of these areas of expertise together, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think we're in a time when there can be a meetings of the minds as they open up.
Yeah, true.
And it's like, you know, it's like a nut as it opens up, you know, to deliver its meat.
Yeah.
So there's lots of nuts out there.
And we may be a couple of them, huh?
Lots of meat. So how do people, I'm looking forward to reading that book. You know, your style of writing is so easy to follow. It's just very easygoing, and you have a really nice writing style. I'd like to compliment you on your book, The Supreme
Self. I appreciate that.
And I have your other book, too, on mysticism, and I haven't started it yet. It's a little bigger.
The History?
And,
yeah. Yeah, you'll enjoy that. That's got a whole education.
Oh yeah, and I'm so grateful to be able to tap into your, you know, many years of experience and research, and you know, it's always refreshing when you find somebody that's enlightened as you seem to be. And,
well, you can find these books at Amazon.com or any of the others as well. But
And then your website too. What's your website address?
Right. All my books are listed on the website, and it tells you a little about them and how to order them. My website is www.swami-abhayananda, abhayananda.com.
And then you also, I actually discovered you through Gerardus Trost's site when I downloaded your free e-books. You have some free e-books that you offered.
That's
correct. Oh, they're wonderful. They're absolutely wonderful. They're just pure spiritual material. And, you know,
anybody who might be interested, they can go to my website, and they can read all about it and get there are three books that I'm offering that were published but are now out of print. And I'm offering them as free e-books. I can email them to them. And one of them is Yaneshwar, who was a 13th century Indian mystic, and tells of his life, and also translates one of his major works. And the other one is Plotinus, and of course everybody knows Plotinus was a 3rd century Roman who wrote the most beautiful philosophy of the One and how it emanates the universe. And the third one is what is the third one? My mind went blank.
Well, it'll be a surprise.
Yaneshwar, Plotinus, and Dattatreya, which is
Dattatreya.
The song of the Avadhut
yes.
Gita. So it's that was
just, you know, I started reading that one, and I just was—I was having chills reading it. It was just—it's
pretty heavy stuff.
I highly recommend that people read them, and you know, you'll get what you get from it. But they're really profound pieces of art, really.
Yeah.
So, Well, I thank you so much, Swami, for spending time with us and with
me. Well, I thank you so much for giving me this opportunity
to
speak with you and with your listeners.
Oh, wonderful. And I wish you the best on your coming book. And just tell us again what the name of the book.
Mysticism Science. And Science.
Science, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And I guess we're just about, we are out. I think I'm even over. Well, thank you again, Swami, and I look forward to reading your new book when it comes out.
Thank you, Lance.
All right, and good
night,
everybody.
Much.
All right, many blessings.
Same to you.